You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 4th of July 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, Ivor Gaber, Director of Political Journalism at City University, and Nina Schick of Open Europe will join me in the studio to discuss today's top stories, including Hamas's offer of a ceasefire, the phenomenon some are determined to call Merkenzi, Ukraine's hopes of retrieving Crimea, and Recep Tayyip Erdogan's designs on Turkey's presidency. Then, lightening the tone somewhat in the second half, author Justin McGurk meets our design editor to discuss his new book, Radical Cities, which explores the architecture afoot in Latin America.
These kind of strange tactics, which actually developed a sense of citizenship, you know, developed a sense of what is good civic behavior. And you start on that and you build on that. And other mayors came in afterwards, but they couldn't have done it without Antanas Mockus changing the way people think about the city.
Persisting with the South American theme as we await Brazil's confrontation with Colombia, we'll review highlights from the first Amazon Film Festival ever held here in London.
La pirataria, velho. Sabe que a gente só mexe com pirataria, né?
Pirataria divulga meu produto.
All coming up on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. An action-packed 60 minutes ahead of which David Spencer has the world news.
Thank you, Monocle 24 News. I'm David Spencer. There have been clashes between police and protesters in Jerusalem after the funeral of a Palestinian teenager murdered in an apparent revenge attack. Mohammed Abu Qader was abducted and killed after the bodies of three missing Israeli teenagers were found in the West Bank. Israel accuses Hamas of the murders. There has been speculation of an Egyptian-brokered peace deal where Hamas would halt its rocket and mortar attacks on southern Israel if the Israeli military ceased its air raids on the Palestinian territory. At least 13 Ukrainian military personnel have been killed in separate incidents in fighting against pro-Russian rebels in eastern Ukraine. 9 others were wounded. The operation to remove the rebels resumed on Tuesday after Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko decided not to renew a ceasefire. India's new Prime Minister has visited Kashmir for the first time since his landslide election victory earlier this year. But Narendra Modi was greeted by largely empty streets as separatists enforced a strike in protest at his arrival. Schools and shops were closed in Srinagar. Mr. Modi opposes autonomy for Kashmir. Rescue workers have pulled a body from the wreckage of a collapsed highway overpass in the Brazilian city of Belo Horizonte, confirming a second death in the accident. The bridge, which was still under construction, is located near one of the World Cup football stadiums. It collapsed on Thursday afternoon as vehicles were passing on a busy road underneath. 22 people were also injured in the accident. Football's world governing body says it will take action against any World Cup ticketing violations if necessary. On Thursday, police in Rio de Janeiro said they identified a FIFA official. They allege helped a group of people to illegally resell World Cup tickets. The investigations led to the arrest of a ring of 11 suspected ticket touts. FIFA's head of media, Delia Fischer.
FIFA and the local authorities will ensure that any violations will be sanctioned accordingly. FIFA takes a firm stance against any form of violation of the ticketing regulations and is very pleased with the great collaboration with the security authorities in our joint efforts to clamp down any unauthorized ticket sales. Any size tickets for future matches will be cancelled and returned into public sale.
The Nigerian government's come under more pressure to negotiate with Boko Haram militants to secure the release of more than 200 schoolgirls. It's now almost 3 months since they were kidnapped from a school in the northeast of the country. A group called the Chibok Residents of Abuja called a news conference in the Nigerian capital to state their demands to the government. Spokesman Pogu Bitrus said they want a security force deployed to protect the area where the girls were taken and more help for those affected.
The immediate establishment of a rehabilitation center in Chibok to address psychological, medical and traumatic effects of the abduction on parents escaped and yet to be rescued girls and the Chibok community.
Spain is to freeze airport tariffs until 2025 in an effort to boost air traffic in the country. The measure comes just 3 weeks after the government put almost half of its heavily indebted airport operator, AENA, up for sale. It owns 46 airports in Spain and also has international interests such as a stake in London's Luton Airport. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thanks, David. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We will be back right after this.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London, 这是 Monocle 24.
Op London, tu é Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette é Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Holanda.
London, Europe,
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House. It's 18.06 in London. That's 13.06 in New York. And it's still 1-0 in Rio, Germany's way. Joining me now with their take on the news here in the studio, we have Ivor Gaber, who's the Director of Political Journalism at City University here in London. Nina Schick as well, Communications Director at the Open Europe think tank. Welcome both. We will start tonight with Israel and Palestine, where there is a possibility of a ceasefire between Israel and Hamas, although the distinction in this context between ceasefire and pause to reload seems a thin one. Hamas has offered to desist with its pointless and counterproductive rocket launches from Gaza if Israel will call off its pointless and counterproductive air raids on Gaza. I am paraphrasing slightly. The olive branch is proffered as the region braces itself for the funeral of Mohammed Abu Khader, the Palestinian youth apparently lynched by Israeli settlers in retaliation for the previous murder of three Israelis by Palestinians. I'll start with you. Why might Hamas be trying to wind this back, if that indeed is what's going on?
Well, there's a sort of above-the-line answer and a below-the-line answer. Above the line, they'd like to see their civilians no longer subject to Israeli rocket attacks. But I think what's really going on here is there is great trepidation in the Gaza Strip about how Israel might yet retaliate against the murder of the three young men who were killed earlier this week. They were killed last week. Their bodies were discovered earlier this week. And I think Hamas wants to wind down the tension. It's expecting some form of Israeli retaliation. It's not these it's not the Israeli bombings in response to the rockets. It's something else, as yet unannounced. And they don't want to exacerbate the situation. I think they're quite pleased that at last they've been able to reopen these channels of communication through the Egyptian security services, which had gone dead. And that was the means by which Israel and Hamas had communicated in the past. And perhaps they're hoping, by responding positively to the Egyptians, to the Egyptians' mediation efforts, that the Egyptians will also be able to mediate about any retaliation that the Israelis might well be planning.
Nina Schick, do you think this is Hamas trying to persuade the Israelis to wind it in a little bit?
I think the Egyptian military intelligence has a large role to play here, because they've been acting as a broker between Israel and Hamas. Of course, Hamas is an offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood, and as the Egyptian regime is cracking down on the Muslim Brotherhood, that's also weakened Hamas. But, you know, it's a cycle that we see so often, as you've already mentioned, and it's an incredibly sad story where we've seen four young people die in an awful, awful way.
Is there a vague possibility, and I'm going to attempt optimism here, which is always something of a fool's errand where the Middle East is concerned, that both sides, at least, if they don't have anything in common, this is the leadership on both sides, have a shared concern that matters might actually escalate beyond anybody's control? We've seen how visceral and raw the anger on both sides is.
Well, I think an interesting thing to mark is that Netanyahu called for, that there shouldn't be violence to retaliate for the murders of the three Israeli teenagers. However, that had a backlash then on social media sites on both sides, both the Israeli and the Palestinian side. There was a lot of calls for revenge. So I think, regardless of what politicians say, because there's just so much anger there on both sides, it's going to be extremely hard to contain.
Now, Ivor, just finally on this subject, is there any cause for optimism that maybe the leaderships on both sides have they have something now in common? They have a shared aim, which is trying to settle this down a little bit.
Well, they've also got something else in common, which they've got extremists. Some people
Indeed.
Might think they're extremists, but they've got extremists outflanking them. Netanyahu is one, I hate to say this, is one of the most moderate members of an extremist extremely right-wing cabinet, and his party is under pressure. They lost seats. He is now being seen as, for what it's worth, a dove. Similarly, Hamas has shown itself unable to control some of the ultra groups in Gaza. It's said that Hamas has not been firing the rockets. And I think that Hamas, particularly, as Nina said, that they're under pressure because of their close alliance with the Muslim Brotherhood, are desperately. That's probably why they did a deal with al-Fatah, with the Palestinian Authority, to try and reunite the two sectors of Palestine. They are under great pressure, it seems to me. But if you want optimism, you just don't look at the Middle East. That's not a place where one does optimism.
Well, we will move seamlessly along to a possibly more heartening example of cooperation as Italy begins its six-month stint in the EU presidency. Matteo Renzi, who is the Prime Minister of Italy since February, is getting generally good reviews, some even suggesting that he could serve as a partner/foyer to Angela Merkel in reforming the EU. At least one normally sane news outlet is even attempting to float the term Merkenzie, about which we shall never again speak. Nina, first of all, what is Renzi doing right? He does have high approval ratings both within Italy and without it.
Yes, well, he's young, dynamic, he's fresh, he's under a lot of pressure to deliver the reforms that Italy needs. So Renzi and Merkel both bring different things to the table. And at least when it comes to the structural reforms that Europe need, both Renzi and Merkel can agree on that. But to say that there's somehow going to be an alliance in reforming Europe is probably not going to happen. And there's one key reason why, because Renzi has actually been pushing Merkel along with François Hollande of France to relax the EU budget rules, which, of course, Germany is not in favour of, because Germany is the principal paymaster of the EU. So,
or an old boring aunt, as Renzi has it.
Or an old boring aunt. So actually, the last few weeks in this battle for the Commission President, you've seen Hollande and Renzi line up on one side versus Berlin on the other. But Merkel has already kind of put her foot down and won that battle, because they were pushing for a new interpretation of the fiscal pact, and now that's already been reduced to, okay, well, we want some more flexibility.
Now, I wonder how solid this German-Italian pact is. There's a story.
I'd much rather we called it that than Merkenzie.
Yeah, well, even my attempt wasn't very good. The Rome-Berlin axis, no, that has really bad connotations.
There's baggage, yeah.
Just recently, in the last few hours, Renzi has hit out at the Bundesbank chief. Over his what he calls improper intervention in Italian politics. And I fear that he's wanting to assert his independence to the Italian electorate to say, I am not Angela's plaything. The timing of this is quite interesting. It's only just broken. And I just wonder if it's a counterbalance. I don't know. Maybe he's playing to a domestic audience there.
No, that's actually a story that was lost in translation. So Jens Weidmann, the head of the Bundesbank, quoted Renzi, but then the Italian papers picked up on that, mistranslated it, and said that Weidmann was attacking Renzi. So that's a story that's been at the fault of the Italian papers, causing a bit of a diplomatic incident, because it never actually happened like that.
Renzi, to go back to his earlier assessment of the EU, did liken it to an old boring aunt. What does he need or want to do, Nina? I'll ask you first, to try turning the EU into a young and interesting aunt.
So Renzi's pushing heavily for the kind of structural reform. So he wants to follow the German model for social employment rules, for example, more flexible labour markets, getting growth back on the table, getting more young people into jobs. However, he's also pushing, and I'll say it again, this is where he will meet the absolute no of Germany for a looser interpretation of the EU fiscal and stability pact. And Germany is not going to buy into that. So interestingly, what this has actually led to is more of an alliance between Germany and the UK, because they have this kind of economically liberal vision of what the EU should be. And Germany has seen in recent weeks with France initially pushing for a more relaxed EU budget rules, that if the UK is out of the EU, then Germany will be held to a southern protectionist bloc.
Ivor, is Renzi's stature either inside Italy or outside it at all compromised by the fact that as yet nobody's actually elected him prime minister?
Well, one enters the murky world of Italian politics, which, having worked in Rome for 2 years, are unlike politics elsewhere. I think it's almost a minor detail that he hasn't been elected prime minister. There are so many other forces in play. Italian politics are very... that was since the breakdown, in the good old days, we had the Christian Democrats and either the Socialists or the Communists, depending, and one knew where one stood.
Was this the good old days when pretty much everybody in Italy got a crack at being prime minister for a few weeks at least?
No, not as long as that, no. No, it was the days when priests stood in the pulpit on a Sunday just before people went to vote and said, we are not allowed to intervene in Italian politics, but we have two messages for you. When you vote, remember you are a Christian and you remember you're a Democrat. So just remember those two words, Christian, Democrat. And that was democracy Italian style. So I don't think that is a huge issue. Clearly, we still have the Berlusconi inheritance, the Banquo's ghost, if you like, at the feast. I think Renzi is clearly doing better in terms of his PR than his predecessors. So I think he has a fighting chance of getting that majority in the two, which he needs. Because I do think also the other complicating factor, Beppe Grillo's movement is fracturing, I think, and some of them, I think, will vote for him.
Nina Schick, within the EU circles, by which I mean the decision makers in the EU, is Italy now, is it perceived by the northern EU nations as a serious and responsible partner or something of a Greece in waiting?
Well, I think they are watching Renzi very carefully because he's been making some very strong statements, and specifically, I know I keep coming back to it, but because of his position on the EU budget. And the interesting thing is that Renzi has taken the lead on this, and France, which is obviously the other big Eurozone country which is struggling economically, has kind of come out, you know, kind of standing behind Renzi a little bit. So the Northern Bloc is watching Renzi very carefully and also with some trepidation and alarm.
In terms of actually having the EU presidency for 6 months, what will Italy be wanting to do with it?
Well, so Renzi will be using this as a platform, of course, to talk about more European unity. You know, let's get growth and jobs back on the agenda. The usual things that European politicians will say. However, the interesting discussions will be happening behind the scenes.
Ivor, also wanted to ask you, Renzi, in one of his first speeches building up to the presidency, has stressed that he's very, very keen on the UK not leaving the EU. How is David Cameron's authority affected by his somewhat kamikaze attempt to stop Juncker? Can you stop something with that metaphor is not going to help us. But you know what I'm saying.
Yeah. Well, of course. I mean, in this country, I read in the press that actually David Cameron had a great triumph, and that 26-2 was a very good result. So whether Italians share that view,
it's twice as good as 27-1.
That's true, as which was our World Cup result. However, just to try and address the, I do think, and having lived in Italy for a while, there, Italians do to some extent identify with the UK as not quite part of the European mainstream. I mean, we know they are much more, but there is that sense of you know, there's a Franco-German/Benelux drive at the heart of Europe. And I think Italians are quite simpatico, as they would say, to the British for a number of reasons. They don't feel, I don't get when I travel there, the sense of hostility might be too strong, but alienation or distance that when you talk to political people in France and Germany, a sense of really getting very fed up with Britain. I don't get that sense in Italy. The Italians perhaps feel they haven't had such a good deal. So my view is that he is a potential ally. I don't think Cameron excites the same hostility. I haven't been reading the Italian newspapers recently, but I don't think he excites the same hostility in Italy. Nina would know this better than me, as he does in France and Germany. Well, certainly France.
Just finally and briefly on this, Nina, is David Cameron at all compromised by what has happened?
Well, there's no doubt that Juncker is acceding to the Commission presidency is a diplomatic blow for David Cameron. However, the interesting thing is that all the other heads of state agreed with David Cameron privately. In fact, Merkel had given him assurances that she would torpedo Juncker once it came to the actual presidency itself. But because of the way that domestic politics played out, and I won't get too much into detail on this, Berlin had to back Juncker. And if you put London v. Berlin and ask the other member states to choose, it's pretty clear who they'll choose. So the interesting thing, the point that I want to make, is that now that they've had that defeat where other EU leaders agreed with Cameron, they might be willing to give the UK a quick win, and that will probably come when the commission, when the country commissioners are selected, and the UK might get a very influential post.
Okay, well, we shall move along now to Kyiv. Ukraine's new defense minister, Valery Heleti, addressed Ukraine's parliament yesterday and made the eye-catching declaration that Ukraine would retake Crimea. He promised, in fact, a victory parade in Sevastopol, although probably wisely did not name a date. Ivor, do we like his chances?
This is the triumph of hope over realism, isn't it? I mean, they should recapture half their country first, i.e. eastern Ukraine, before worrying about Crimea. I think... From my understanding and my knowledge of that part of the world, I think Crimea is long gone. And the Russians will fight, metaphorically and maybe literally, for Crimea in a way they're certainly not going to for eastern Ukraine. But having said that, an incoming Minister of Defence in Kyiv has to say that. He cannot concede.
See, I wonder if he does. I mean, because Poroshenko said that at his inauguration. He did say something like, we will never give up on Crimea, which is a fairly harmless rhetorical construct, the kind of thing you have to say. Whereas the Defence Minister has said, we're going to go in there and get it back. Nina, why would he say that if it is, and it would seem to be militarily impossible?
Well, recently we've seen the situation seemingly de-escalating a little bit. So comments like that are only going to aggravate and antagonize Putin and Russian further. So what it shows us is that the situation remains volatile. So despite Russia drawing back some of its troops from the Ukrainian border, Putin drawing back from the assurance that he had from the parliament in Russia that he could invade eastern Ukraine, you know, the situation still remains tense. And we've seen that in recent days as well, that events have taken a turn also from the EU. They've been saying that, you know, Russia hasn't done enough and that they might pursue these broader economic sanctions, which have been on the table. And interestingly, we had a leak today from the Russian Treasury saying that economic sanctions would actually hurt the economy a lot.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. You are listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, Ivor Gaber, Director of Political Journalism at City University, Nina Schick of Open Europe still with me. When we return, we'll be looking at a tale of two men seeking the presidency in their home nations of Turkey and France.
The Monocle app puts Monocle 24's pacey mix of current affairs, business, culture and music in your pocket. Whether it's midnight in Marunouchi or sunrise in Sydney, tune in to our around-the-clock audio service live from Midori House. Or download and replay your favourite programmes using the Time Shift feature. Also at your fingertips, our complete global travel guide. Get all this and more on the go on the Monocle app.
And welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me is Ivor Gaber from City University, Nina Schick of Open Europe. Now, Turkey's prime minister since 2003, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, has latterly been doing a fairly convincing impression of someone who has been in power too long. Whenever a national leader starts blaming his problems on conspiracies, it's generally a fail-safe indicator that it's time to start work on the memoirs. However, Erdogan plans to defy the forces arrayed against him, variously named by him or his circle, as the CIA, Twitter, the BBC, CNN, the interest rate lobby, Lufthansa, telekinetic assassins and the elders of Zion, and seek his country's presidency. Nina Schick, first of all, what could possibly go wrong?
Well, it seems that it's positive that he will probably become the president. Now, that's a post, interestingly, that's largely symbolic. So the fact that he's going for this is, you know, very much a symbol of him trying to stay in power for another 10 years. The interesting thing about that, even though he's renowned internationally for his authoritarian tendencies, the swing vote in this might actually be the Kurdish voters, because he's kind of seen to them as their best hope of peace. I think he'll win. He's got 55% backing.
Ivor, I alluded there to some of his more eccentric outbursts in recent months and years.
Can I just say, you must be very disappointed Monocle weren't on that list, but we're working on that.
We're working on that right now, in fact, and that's hopefully next time he unveils his enemies list, we will crack it. Is he still entirely with us? It's not a facetious question. I think there's something about being in power too long is not good for people.
Well, I think he would have been seen to have been in power too long had the Syria crisis not burst. I think that distracted, because don't forget, was it a year ago or so, Istanbul exploded.
Yeah.
And he was facing a very precarious situation. I mean, Syria had already happened, but it hadn't become the crisis. I'm probably getting my timing wrong, but you're following my drift. I think Syria, in that sense, saved him because there's nothing like an external crisis to keep, I won't say he's not a dictator, but to keep authoritarians in power. So I think that his time was running out, although I have to say he had been a very successful premier.
In many respects,
well,
yes.
Certainly in economic terms, and certainly in terms of challenging the power of the military in Turkey, which for Democrats like myself required challenging. But, of course, it wasn't all on the plus side. I'll just make one more observation, which is pretty obvious, is that he's been taking lessons from Mr. Putin, who did the reverse, didn't he?
The
narrative was the same. He's clearly going to stay in power as long as he possibly can. And at the moment, the opposition does not look like it's going to be in a position to challenge either him. Well, he will win the presidency because it's. Oh, actually, no. This is the first time
it's elected. The first elected one, yes.
Yeah, but the opposition is unlikely to win that vote, as I understand it. And similarly, he will have a government of his liking, of a prime minister. So his power will continue for the foreseeable future, as far as I can see.
Nina, final thought on Erdogan. How much does he represent one side of what a division that appeared in Turkey, certainly around the Gezi Park protests, between the kind of urban, modern, secular Turkey as represented by much of Istanbul and certainly by the protesters in Gezi Park, and the slightly more conservative, religious variation of Turkey? I mean, that division has always existed, but is it actually getting further apart?
Well, that's the fear. I mean, his party, the AKP, is the most electorally successful Islamist-rooted party. And he's very much playing up to the, you know, more conservative Muslim middle classes. And the fear is that as he extends his power, that his politics will become more divisive in society. But having said that, there's an interesting twist there, that the Kurds could be the swing vote.
Well, finally, for this first half hour, and in further adventures in not knowing when to quit, Nicolas Sarkozy is still believed intent on having a crack at a return to France's presidency in 2017. His brief stint as a guest of the gendarmes this week would appear to be unhelpful, but as he's doubtless reminding himself, Napoleon returned from worse. Nina, is Sarkozy done for or not?
No, he's not done for yet. You know, there's always a scandal in French politics. He said he hasn't decided yet, and we'll find out in November whether or not he's going to be running for the leadership of the UMP. Now, it's always been a question of not if he'll come back, but when he'll come back, because the centre-right party, his party, the UMP in France, is really going through the doldrums, and he's the most popular person to kind of save it. But the interesting thing is that now the centre-right UMP, including Jacques Chirac and Sarkozy, both of them have been plagued by scandal. So the real winner in this could actually be the Front National when they sweep up discontented voters in the next election, Marine Le Pen.
Ivor, as Nina just suggested, there is always a scandal in French politics. So, but are the French that inured to it? Will French voters really be bothered by this, or will they just sort of shrug and think that's what politicians do?
Well, there certainly seems to be a tradition, if that's the right word, that ex-presidents go straight to the police station after their stint in office. I think what I don't know where the French voters are thinking is, I'm thinking this, that this plays into Hollande's hands in a not the obvious way. But it could mean that in the way the French presidential election system works, and we're not far 2015,
the 2017
next
election, it could well be if Sarkozy and his party remain unpopular, Marine Le Pen could be the main challenger. And in the runoff, Hollande would be more confident, if he is going to be the candidate, Hollande would be more confident of beating Marine Le Pen, I think, than he would be of beating Sarkozy.
It would be kind of a rerun of 2002. If anybody but Le Pen Sr. had run against Chirac, they probably would have beaten him. Mm. For that reason, obviously, Sarkozy or people close to him are going to claim that the whole thing is a setup and a stunt, and that it's probably all going to get a bit Erdogan. Does anyone actually believe that?
Well, this is the interesting thing, and this is what I expect will happen. He'll probably launch on a Berlusconi-style campaign against politicized judges to try and win the favor back. But whether or not the French electorate's going to buy that remains to be seen. And as I said, the biggest risk in all of this, or the biggest winner in all of this scandal, could actually be the Front National.
We will leave it there on that happy thought. Nina Schick of Open Europe, Ivor Gaber of City University, thank you both very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Лондрис, Нова Йорк, Токио.
Лондон, Нью Йорк, Токио. Дете е Monocle 24.
Лондонист, Нью Йоркист, Токиост. Се е Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
And there's plenty still to come in the second half of today's Midori House. Vanessa Robinson from the Amazon Film Festival will take me through some of the highlights on in that festival in London at the moment. Justin McGurk will explore the radical cities that feature in his book on Latin American architecture. And Sasha Eisenberg will take us through the day's news out of Washington. But before we get started on all that, David Spencer has the headlines.
Thank you. Thousands of angry Palestinians have called for a new uprising against Israel during the funeral of a teenager they believe was kidnapped and killed by far-right Jews. Police used tear gas, stun grenades and rubber bullets during the confrontations in Jerusalem. Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki has refused to give up his quest for a third term in power, defying a chorus of critics demanding his replacement as the country battles Sunni insurgents. He said he wouldn't step aside. Police in Macedonia have fired tear gas and stun grenades in clashes with around 2,000 ethnic Albanians. They've taken to the streets of the capital Skopje to protest against the jailing of six people for murder and terrorism. France has joined the UK in tightening airport security for flights to the United States. The move comes after a request from US authorities. Airlines with direct flights to the States have been told to tighten screening of mobile phones and shoes in response to intelligence reports of increased threats from Al-Qaeda-affiliated militant groups. In the US, Hurricane Arthur has hit the North Carolina coast, but causing less damage than feared after weakening as it moved out to sea. However, the storm affected the Independence Day holiday for thousands of Americans, with many homes without power. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, David. Welcome back to Midori House. Time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. Today, it's the turn of our man in DC, Sasha Eisenberg. Sasha, first up, the latest installment in the United States' ongoing argument over whether the reproductive rights of women are anybody's damn business but their own.
Yeah, another decision to bookend the week from the Supreme Court, which at the start of the week ruled in this case called Hobby Lobby that a company owned by a religious Christian family did not have to include certain types of contraception as part of the health insurance that they offered their employees. And just late yesterday, there was a ruling that a Christian college basically could opt out as well of some of the provisions of the bill. What we're seeing here, I think, generally is from the court a recognition that companies and institutions have a fair amount of religious right that was previously granted only to individual citizens. But I think we're starting to see politically that this is going to become this sort of new cause of Christian conservatives in the United States. They've basically given up on broadly imposing their will on issues like abortion or gay rights or prayer in school on the broader population. They see a country becoming more secular. Now it's very much about sort of protecting the rights of the religious as a sort of besieged minority. And that's a real shift after, I think, 20 years of religious conservatives talking about themselves as part of sort of a big moral majority. Now they're talking about themselves as a sort of victimized minority group.
I am enjoying the idea of religious believers being a persecuted minority in the United States of all places. Is there not any suggestion we're getting into a bit of a weird area where the Supreme Court of all institutions can decide that corporations and organizations are not necessarily bound by the law if they decide they don't like it?
Yeah, I mean, this is a sort of, you know, we saw the makings of this in the political arena with Citizens United, the idea that corporations have speech rights in the context of campaign spending. Now we're seeing the idea that corporations have the ability to assert a religious freedom. even if they're profit-making, I mean, in the past there was a distinction made between non-profit religious institutions. The clearest one was, you know, churches or synagogues, the idea that they wouldn't be forced to do things against their religious creed. That was sort of sensible. Then there was a question about non-profit colleges or universities that had a religious identification. That became a little more problematic because a lot of them run hospital systems or things that are not overtly theological or spiritual. Now we're talking about a company that, in the case of Hobby Lobby, sells craft supplies, but the family that owns it happens to be very religious. And you know, the question is always with the Supreme Court is, where do you draw the line in a way that creates a sort of consistent rule? And we're seeing that at least this court is willing to give incredible leeway to the definition of an institution with religious values at its core.
Okay, I want to move along to another story, which is kind of a perfect storm for someone like me who considers, one considers the Declaration of Independence one of the finest things in the English language and is also a massive punctuation nerd. This cunningly brings both of those together.
Yeah, this is a roiling debate among historians and archivists that started when a professor at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton, New Jersey, argues that we've basically mispunctuated arguably the most important sentence in the Declaration of Independence, the one that starts, "We hold these truths to be self-evident." And currently, we have seen the sort of standard transcription of this ending the sentence after the words "life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." She argues that what we've seen as a period probably is not actually a period, and that sentence goes on into the next phrase, which says, "Instituted among men, deriving their powers from the consent of the governed." On some level, this is a sort of detective story, you know, devoted to ink on parchment, but more broadly, there's a question about whether these sort of American values of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness are sort of philosophically linked to the idea of having a strong government.
And finally, Sasha, we started talking about a legislative attempt to make access to contraception more difficult for women, and yet in the same week that happens, another court decides to make it easier for people to ride around on Segways. What is going on over there?
Yeah, this was a fun Washington, D.C. story, sort of frontiers of libertarianism where you least expect it. The city for about 100 years has required tour guides to be regulated. I think some of this was a sort of liability issue. Tour guides are sort of regularly leading people in and out of traffic. But it also became a certification procedure, and tour guides, as they do in a lot of cities in the U.S., have to pass a test showing their historical knowledge and their way of getting around. You had a small company that wanted to offer tours on Segways, which seemed sort of aggressively anti-intellectual, but potentially good fun for people that want to wheel around. And the sort of tour guide association was trying to block them. And so they successfully sued, and a federal court struck down the city's regulations on tour guide approval. So you now can be led by a tour guide who knows nothing of history and possibly doesn't know a whole lot about how to keep you safe in traffic.
The story you've brought us about this in the Washington Post does quote one Segway tour guide as remembering that once they had to fish a Segway out of Baltimore Harbor, and on that note of vexatious foreign produce being dumped in the water, Sasha, I shall wish you a happy July 4th and thank you for joining us. Up next, Monocle's design editor Tom Morris will discuss Justin McGurk's latest book on Latin America's radical cities.
Global affairs, culture, business, design, or urbanism. At Monocle 24, we've got it covered. And when it comes to transport and travel, you need look no further. From automobile innovators to the creative minds shaping the in-flight experience, we speak to the experts to ensure you have all the industry news you'll ever need. In New York, our transport editor, Tristan McAllister.
Whether it's a closer look at the global aviation heavyweights or embedding with the people who keep Alaska's state ferry system afloat, we take you to the people and the places that make our world move.
Take to the skies, the rails, the seas, or the roads with Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Our next guest has a new book that goes some way to detailing the effects of mass urbanization in Latin America. In Radical Cities Across Latin America in Search of a New Architecture, Justin McGurk explores how extreme cities have created extreme conditions. It's a story of urban sprawl, failed mass housing, but also of innovation and daring development in unlikely places. Monocle's design editor Tom Morris spoke to Justin McGurk before we came to air.
Medellin is a kind of headline exemplar, because partly because it's such an unlikely story. I mean, no one thought that if you took the murder capital of the world in the late 90s, that if you injected public space and good architecture and an education program, that it would completely transform the social dynamic of the city. But it did. And the way it did is complex. It did so by incorporating the community's own wishes. It did so by a massive program of education, and by bringing public spaces and beautiful architecture into the poorest parts of the city that had been neglected for decades, thereby kind of rebalancing the inequality of the city and creating places that suddenly the kind of middle classes had to respect, that they were kind of curious about. You see what I mean? It kind of bridged that social, psychological divide between barrio and formal city.
And is it still successful? What was your sort of impression when you were there?
It is successful. I mean, it's a different administration now, and they have slightly different ideas, and perhaps those ideas are not quite as progressive as the ones under Mayor Sergio Fajardo in the early 2000s or mid-2000s, but it's certainly a city that's already been transformed. It still has problems. I mean, you know, the crime hasn't gone away altogether, but it's a very different place now than it was in the 90s, for sure.
I'm interested in particularly your experience of some of the great pieces of architecture in Latin America. I'd love to hear you tell us more about the Torre David and in Caracas, which is a really, must have been quite a bizarre place to visit.
I mean, Torre David is a kind of extraordinary one-off accidental phenomenon. And it's become a kind of weird cause célèbre. It's appeared all over the place. It was in an episode of Homeland fairly recently, for all the wrong reasons, you know, where they portray it as a kind of den of crime and drug abuse. But it's really not that. I mean, for me, Torre David is a very simple, symbolic story. It's the taking of a redundant piece of financial speculation that failed and turning it into social capital. And the key question that I asked about it, and that I'm sure the residents asked themselves, is that why should thousands of poor people, millions of poor people live in slums on the periphery when there are 45-story empty skyscrapers in the city center? And they took what was effectively a dead concrete skeleton and brought life in, brought services, electricity, water. They've occupied it, inhabited it in a way that no one thought was possible. And they've made what's effectively an impossible typology, because a skyscraper only exists because of the invention of the elevator. There is no elevator. So people are walking up and down 28, 30 stories every day in some cases. And that wasn't meant to be possible.
What's it like inside now?
It's a surprising place. I mean, it takes a while to get used to. When you first get there, it's kind of extremely, it just feels kind of totally outlandish. A bit like a vertical slum, although I prefer not to call it a slum in any way. But, you know, you spend a couple of days there, and I spent a week in there, in fact, and it starts to become weirdly normal. You start to get used to these strange, you know, trips up and down. There is commerce, there's everything. It's more like a vertical village, because there's street life, but it happens in the corridors. There's shops, but they're on, you know, every few floors you'll find a bodega, so that you don't have to go down 28 stories when you need milk. And there's a whole economy in there. You know, it's almost a kind of, it's a semi-self-sufficient urban kind of high-rise.
There is something about Latin America, isn't it, that I guess is unique in it. Latin Americans being able to sort of invent their own kind of social and urban norms of, you know, what a street is and what a neighborhood is, that just operates completely outside that sort of renegade part of the
Absolutely,
the
no,
continent.
I think you're spot on. I mean, I think one of the appeals of this whole book and this research was that Latin America has, for years, thrown up these incredible experiments and these unusual typologies, whether it's cable cars to the slums or escalators up to the slums, or, you know, occupied skyscrapers, or architects building half houses for people, or, I mean, the book is just full of these extraordinary test cases.
And that's a great example, isn't it? The social housing project in Chile that I think we've definitely mentioned a monocle before, but it's really extraordinary. If you could explain that project.
Sure. I mean, and it's been well documented, but this is, we're talking about Alejandro Aravena's project in the north of Chile to build people half houses, effectively. He always says, if you haven't got enough money to build people a house, build them half a house and let them do the other half themselves. It's deeply pragmatic stuff. I mean, it's been lionized in the media, or at least it was when it was first published. And, you know, one does have to ask difficult questions about it. You know, is that, if we're talking about government funding, is that the best way to, you know, should they just provide houses or should they provide platforms, as this has been described, for people to kind of complete themselves? I think there's an argument that they should provide platforms if that's the best they can do. In fact, in Chile, since that project was first initiated, the budget for housing has gone up and they no longer need such a kind of radical, extreme solution. But it could be very valuable elsewhere. Mm. I'm thinking India or Africa. And then it could be tested at a certain scale, which it hasn't really been yet.
Are there any other interesting examples of exciting, innovative social housing projects?
There are many. I mean, unfortunately, there was one in Rio which got sidelined. But I mean, I think when I'm talking about housing, interestingly, in the book, I'm looking back. The book, there's constantly flashbacks to kind of high points of modernist housing and then seeing what happened afterwards. But for me, some of the more interesting aspects of the book are not so much about housing, but more about less predictable solutions. I'm thinking of, for example, the former mayor of Bogota, Antanas Mockus, who was a philosophy professor who just didn't have the budget to build things. And he completely transformed Bogota by changing the way citizens behave. And he did that through behavioral experiments, like changing the traffic police for mime artists and giving drivers red cards to shame each other when they were driving badly, red cards like the ones referees use. These kind of strange tactics, which actually developed a sense of citizenship in what was a lawless place, really, you know, developed a sense of what is good civic behavior. And you start on that and you build on that. And other mayors came in afterwards and built transport links and bike lanes and bus lanes and things, but they couldn't have done it without Antanas Mockus changing the way people think about the city.
That was Justin McGuirk, the author, rather, of Radical Cities Across Latin America in Search of a New Architecture, speaking to Monocle's design editor, Tom Morris. It's 1846, near enough, in London. It's still Germany 1, France 0 in Rio. We still have the Amazon Film Festival to come, but to take us there, here is some music from Brazil. This is Marcos Valle with Estrela. Marcos Valle there with Estrela. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24, now in injury time, still Germany 1, France 0. And it is time now to review the best, sometimes the worst, in the arts, which is what we do at the end of the show. Today we're looking at film, specifically at a film festival specialising in films from the Amazon. Vanessa Robinson from the Amazon Film Festival, which is on in London next week at Rich Mix in Shoreditch, joins me now. Vanessa, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you.
first of all, tell me a bit about the festival. How many films about, pertaining or from the Amazon are there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we have, we try to separate it in 2 days. We try to talk about the culture in the Amazon region. That's the movies produced and directed by local filmmakers. And the third day, the second day, we try to talk about the political issues in the Amazon. And it was easier for us to find movies with subtitles in English from filmmakers that live and or work outside the Amazon region. So from the Amazon, we have like 4 documentaries, and then we have more three documentaries from filmmakers that live outside the Amazon, but they are Brazilians.
Okay. Well, we have clips from a few of the films that you're showing at the film festival. The first of which is, and I'm going to apologise in advance right now for everything I'm going to mispronounce in the next 6 or 7 minutes. The first one is Brega. Is that near enough?
Yeah, Brega, yeah.
Not bad. Maybe I was a bit soft on the G. Can you introduce it a bit and then we will play a clip from it?
Yeah. So I have to apologise for my English as well. So for
it's a lot better than my Portuguese.
Mistake. But yeah, Brega, yeah, it's directed by Vlad Cunha and Gustavo Godinho. There are 2 filmmakers from Belém do Pará, and it's about Tecnobrega that we call it. It's not just just a musical style, but it's more than this. Tecnobrega is a movement from the periferias that we call in Belém. This when the internet arrived in the Amazon region, it was the only way for them to listen and to produce the music from from the rest of the world. It was very difficult for us in the Amazon to, you know, to listen Beatles or to listen another kind of style apart from the commercial radios. And for the artists there, the Technobreg was a way to produce and to sell the song. You know, so it was really funny because we have the soap operas in Brazil with mm-hmm. Madre Deus, for example. Then you walk in the streets in Belém and then you can listen Madre Deus in a Technobreg version with no... you know, with no worry about copyright. So it's amazing, incredible documentary about before, even before Creative Commons. It's something amazing that's happening in the Amazon.
Okay, well, we have a clip from that.
Da pirataria, velho. Sabe que a gente só mexe com pirataria, né?
Pirataria divulga meu produto, entendeu? Sem me cobrar nada.
O cantor aqui no Pará não ganha dinheiro com venda de CD, com venda de música. Ele ganha dinheiro com show.
Pirataria é
a clip there from Brega, one of the films playing at the Amazon Film Festival in London this weekend. The second film that we were going to talk about is Daughters of Chiquita. Introduce that, if you would.
Yes, Daughters of Chiquita was directed by Priscilla Brasil. Priscilla is an amazing, strong woman. It is her first movie. And it was 2004, I think. So it was because, you know, we have this big religious movement in Brazil and we call Ciro de Nazaré in Belém. It's 2 million people in just one day. But it's the only moment that everyone that kind of get together. And there is this amazing party that we call Filhas da Chiquita that is during the Ciro de Nazaré. And it's a tribute from the LGBT movement mm-hmm. to the saint. So at the same time that you see a lot of Catholics praying for the saint, you see the movement, the LGBT movement, the kind of praying as well with no prejudice. It's just amazing to see them together.
Okay, yeah. We have a clip of that as well. This is Daughters of Chiquita.
Só por isso eu acho que podia dar, gente, né?
Viado tem a obrigação de beber e se divertir como eu estou me divertindo aqui também.
Que acolher a pessoa, tudo bem. Mas a pouca vergonha das pessoas...
A clip there from Daughters of Chiquita playing at the Amazon Film Festival this weekend. We're going to move on now to a couple of the documentaries, I guess, looking at political issues in the Amazon region. Obviously, and unsurprisingly, they focus particularly on questions of environmental politics. Corumbaria, which is sort of stretches back over 20 years mm-hmm. Of video activism. What story is this telling over the decades?
Yeah, Corumbiara is a kind of classic movie about the problems in the Amazon. And then I think it's really important to show it now in 2014 and show that nothing has happened, nothing has changed in the kind of the politics about the indigenous tribe, to preserve the indigenous tribe. So it's a documentary to show that shows how they try to find the remains of this indigenous tribe and how difficult it was to deal with all the political issues in that place and how the government really don't care about the situation. So nothing has changed, in fact.
Okay, we have a clip from Corumbiara.
Eles vieram aqui avisar o senhor não foi abrir. Se o senhor não estiver satisfeito, o senhor entra com uma representação judicial contra nós, isso é finito.
And what were we listening to there? What was going on? For those of us whose local languages aren't what they might be.
Sorry, can you repeat?
What was occurring in that clip? In that particular clip we just listened to?
Oh, yeah, so the guy is trying to find information about the... because what happened was that this indigenous tribe, they just disappeared, they vanished. So they're trying to find information about what happened with them and in this place, in this specific place, but they don't want to give them any information about this.
Okay.
So Vicente Carelli is a guy that he dedicated all his life to trying to find what is happening with the indigenous tribes in Brazil. And it's very important professional in this area.
The final film that you want to talk about was Toxic, which is another investigation into the nasty side of environmental politics in the Amazon.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. And again, I think it's important we say that people used to see Amazon with this exotic place, very mystic place. And I think sometimes we have to try to go more deep in the political issues and the problems that Amazon has, and the toxic, try to show how complicated is the land dispute in the Amazon, and even now, even 2014.
Okay, well, all those films and others being shown at the Amazon Film Festival in London this weekend. That's at Rich Mix in Shoreditch, which nearly rhymed. It should be easy to remember. Vanessa Robinson from the Amazon Film Festival, thank you for joining us. That is all we have time for on today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guests, Ivor Gaber and Nina Schick, who were with us for the first half hour. Today's show was produced by Alan John, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Carlotta Rabello, and our studio manager was Chris Chilver. Next, after the headlines, Marcus Hippie has the menu. At 2200 hours, I'm back with Marcus for our special transatlantic July the 4th edition of the Monocle Daily. This show returns on Monday at 1800 hours. But for this edition of Midori House, it's goodbye and thanks for listening.
London. Tao Beijing.
This is Monocle 24.
Nach Amsterdam.
A Bogota.
To Hong Kong.
All around the world.
This is Monocle 24.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world-famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.